Welcome to 2819. I'm Sandra Dimas.
And I'm Brian Rombacher.
And we have a stupendous show for you this week.
I like that intro.
Yeah.
We'll be hearing from Pastor Jeff Vines, Abdu Murray of RZIM, and Hollywood Prayer Network leaders Jim and Karen Covell.
Yeah, we have some really fun topics this week. We're going to be addressing topics such as the strongest evidence for Christianity and seeing Hollywood as a mission field. I'm so excited for that conversation.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that one too. First up, we have RTB 101, where Hugh Ross and Krista Bontrager will be discussing the overview of the RTB flood model.
Let's check it out.
Now it's time for RTB 101, where we discuss practical questions to equip you to share your faith more effectively. And here to help me talk about RTB's flood model is astrophysicist Dr. Hugh Ross. Welcome back, Hugh.
Hello.
Always glad to have you here. Now, Hugh, we take the position at Reasons to Believe that the first 11 chapters of Genesis are, in fact, history. They reflect real events.
Real events.
So we want to get that down right away. Now, our friends who are young earth creationists would say with the Noah story that's within those first 11 chapters of Genesis, they would say that that story describes a global flood event, that of water that covered the whole planet. We take a little different position. So talk us through kind of the key features of our flood model.
Well, like with any biblical issue, you want to look at the entire Bible. A lot of people think Genesis 6, 7, and 8 are the only places that the Bible addresses Noah's flood. 2 Peter addresses it. The poetic books address it. So you really want to look at everything the Bible's got to say about the flood of Noah. And when you go to the New Testament, for example, 2 Peter 2, 5 says the world of ungodly people was flooded, which is basically defining the world. I mean, and also you notice in 2 Peter 3, 5, and 6, Peter says the world at the time that it existed. So in both cases, the Greek word cosmos is qualified with an adjective, meaning that we're to look at less than the entire globe. It's the world of ungodly people was flooded. And from what we see in the first 11 chapters of Genesis, by the time of Noah, human beings had yet to build cities in Antarctica and Greenland. And therefore, there would be no need for God to flood Antarctica and Greenland. But I think the most explicit texts are those we see in Job, Psalms, and Proverbs. Psalm 104, the longest of the creation psalms, when it addresses creation day 3, that's verses 5, 6, 7, and 8, talks about God transforming our planet from a water world where there's no continents or islands, just water in the surface of the earth, to a world where you've got continents, islands, and oceans. And verse 9 says, never again will water cover the whole face of the earth. So there's an explicit statement. Once we've got continents on the face of the earth, never again are we going to return to a water world. Now that would allow the world of ungodly people to be flooded, but not the entire planet to be flooded. And I find it compelling too. In three other Psalms, and in Job 38 and Proverbs 8, it likewise speaks about God creating permanent barriers to the waters once the continents are in place. So multiple places we have this declaration that although it was the whole world of ungodly people, including all the animals, soulish animals that were associated with them, it wasn't the entire planet.
So let me try to summarize a couple of key points that you made there. One is that the flood did not cover the entire planet. It was geographically local. A second point that you made is that it wiped out all of humanity.
Except for those on board the ark.
Except for those on the ark. Very good. And the third point you made is that these other passages, Psalm 104, Proverbs 8, Job 38, those describe the initial creation days that are described back in Genesis chapter 1.
Right.
That has nothing to do with Noah's flood. Those are not descriptions of Noah's flood.
They're not descriptions of Noah's flood, but they are descriptions, detailed descriptions of creation day 3, with the added statement that once the continents are in place, the water will never again cover the whole face of the earth.
Okay.
Which rules out the possibility that Noah's flood could be global in extent. And as I talk to my young earth friends, they frequently cite Genesis 7, 11, and following our talks about all the mountains being covered with water to a depth of 15 cubits.
Well, that was going to be my next question, okay, is what do you do with the kind of some of this other biblical data that seems to say that all the high mountains on the planet were covered?
Right. Well, again, we make the point that in biblical Hebrew, you got only a small vocabulary. So the word translated mountains is equivalent to the word for hills or mounds. And the word high there could also mean elevated. So like all the elevated hills that are visible to Noah from a position on top of the ark. And I think the clincher is what you see in Genesis 8, 5, and 9. And this is the part where the floodwaters are receding. And Noah releases a dove. And in verse 5, Noah's looking up from the top of the ark and he can see the distant hills. He releases the dove. In verse 9, it tells us from the dove's perspective, water covered the whole face of the earth. The same phrase you see in Genesis 7:19. So it tells us that just because Genesis 7:19 says all the high or elevated hills and mountains were covered by 15 cubits of water, doesn't mean we're talking about all the mountains on the entire face of the earth. Rather, it's all the mountains from the viewpoint of Noah, just like all the hills and mountains from the viewpoint of the dove. So the phrase over the entire face of the earth needs to be understood in the context of the observer.
Another helpful point for me when I was studying this is to understand that the word that's translated in English for the whole earth just can also mean the whole land.
Right.
It doesn't have to encompass the entire planet.
Also, you see in Genesis 8 the use of the word karabah in Hebrew, and that's a word that can never be used to refer to the entire surface of the earth.
Okay. So when we're talking to non-Christians and the topic of Noah's flood comes up, what have you experienced that this taking this strategy or this approach is helpful with them?
Well, many non-Christians think that the Bible teaches that the flood of Noah must be global. And for them to discover that the Bible doesn't teach that, but rather teaches a flood that encompasses all of humanity and their soulish animals and not necessarily the whole planet, now they're willing to take the Bible as a serious, inerrant document.
So it begins to remove an obstacle.
It does.
Very good. Well, thanks, Hugh, for helping us kind of think this part of our creation model through. It's an important thing that comes up a lot when we're sharing our faith. And I do want to encourage you, if you haven't yet, check out Hugh's blog. Just go to our website, reasons.org, and search for Today's New Reason to Believe.
Did you know that today, a greater percentage of the world's population than ever before is Christian? No matter what you hear, what the media tells you, Christianity is still the number one religion in the world. It has somewhere around 50,000 new converts every day. World is bigger than you think. My good friend Ravi Zacharias, he and I were talking about this not too many weeks ago, and I said, Dr. Zacharias, give me a prognosis of the church in America. And he said, well, you know, the social prognosticators would have you believe that the Bible will be eradicated. And if you've ever listened to Ravi, you know that he loves to talk about Voltaire, how he said that the Bible would be eradicated, the church would die, and then he died and his house was turned into a printing press for Bibles. I love that story. But he says the social prognosticators would have you believe that Christianity's dead or dying. He says nothing could be further from the truth. In Russia, we have over 80 million Christians and growing. In China, 100 million and growing. And he said God, faith, Jesus are all alive and well. It's just that the center of Christianity has shifted. Now, I didn't think much about it at the time because he had taken me to his favorite Indian restaurant. I was too busy enjoying culinary delights, as he would call them. What does he mean? It's just that the center of Christianity has shifted. Andrew Walls, a respected historian concerning world Christianity, reminds us that wherever the world's religions began, that place continues to be their center today. Islam has its Arabia, its Mecca. Buddhism is primarily a Far East religion. Hinduism has its India and is primarily an Indian religion. But Christianity is the exception. Its center is always moving. from Jerusalem to the Hellenistic Gentiles, from the Hellenistic Mediterranean world to Alexandria, then to North Africa, then to Rome, then to the Northern Europeans, to the Franks, the Anglo-Saxons, the Celts, all of Europe and beyond. But then in the 20th century, something interesting began to happen. Christianity began to recede in Europe and North America, and she began to flourish in Latin America, Asia, and Africa. So that in the past decade, a major corner was turned. For the first time in human history, more than 50% of the Christians in the world now live in the Southern Hemisphere. Why? Andrew Walls says, one must conclude there's a certain vulnerability, a fragility at the heart of Christianity. You might say that there's a certain vulnerability of the cross. Dr. Tim Keller, in his book King's Cross, elaborates on this statement. He says, the heart of the gospel is the cross, and the cross is all about giving up power, pouring out resources, and serving. When Christianity is in a place of power and wealth for a long period, the radical message of sin and grace and the cross can become muted or even lost. Then Christianity starts to transmute into a nice, safe religion, one that's for respectable people who try to be good. And eventually, it becomes virtually dormant in those places, and the center moves somewhere else. Now, if you're following, you know where we're going with this, right? The gospel is still going out into the world. Christianity was a world religion long before it was a European one. Still today, Christianity continues to be a religion that is the most distributed across cultures and continents. No other faith has so extensively crossed the cultural divisions of humanity and found a place in so many diverse cultures. Sometimes university students will say to me, but Jeff, I don't like Christianity because it's so exclusive. And I like to remind them that all religions are exclusive. But I'll tell you something about Jesus. He's the most inclusive exclusivist you'll ever find. Because no matter where you were born, what tribe you were born in, what caste system, whatever, all who call on the name of the Lord shall be saved.
Welcome to Culture Talk. This is where we talk about culturally relevant topics and how they can be used to share your faith with someone new. Today we have a special clip from Jim and Karen Cavell from the Hollywood Prayer Network. Let's check it out.
Well, some people do think that it's a smoke-filled room full of nasty people trying to destroy the world, you know. It's not. It's people who God created, who are very creative. And because they're so creative, they sometimes don't fit in the box that Christians are most comfortable with. And so there's this misconception that they're bad, evil people. We love the people in Hollywood. They're smart. They're creative. They're passionate. A lot of them just don't know Jesus. Yeah. And so it's a combination of many people now who know the Lord. We know of over 10,000 Christians in Hollywood now who are working as professionals. And then there are people who don't know the Lord, but they want to know truth. They're seeking after it. Mm-hmm. They just don't want to be told what to do. They don't want to be boycotted. Yeah. They don't want people to get mad at them for living their lives. Mm-hmm. But what happens is we as Christians build relationships and friendships with them, and we get a chance to share our faith, to learn about their story, they learn about ours, and it becomes like any other workplace in the world, really. Yeah.
So many people come from, literally come from a church background to Hollywood, mm-hmm. and in the music world, where I'm from, if you watch American Idol, 9 out of 10 contestants are all worship leaders.
Yeah.
Because where else can you be? And perform every week and get your musical chops together. Just about every R&B entertainer alive was raised in the church, sang in the church, and so they have a faith background. And so when they come to Hollywood, there needs to be someone there to affirm them that they're going to the right place. Now, the church has traditionally done not a very good job of affirming people that come here. They say, if you go there, you're going to lose your faith.
Right.
So that's the church's lack of faith on their part to send them here to be missionaries in the world's most influential mission place.
Right, and that's such a great point, because it is true that unfortunately sometimes churches don't necessarily encourage arts and pursuit of arts.
I think that's really a work of the enemy to keep Christians away from such a powerful way to present truth. Mm. really, I've seen that, you know, there are people that dictators, fascists come into countries. The first things they get rid of are religion and art because they're intangible powers. And you can speak any message you want through art. And that touches people's hearts in a way that will never be touched if it's just facts to their head. Mm-hmm. And so there's a great old director, Ingmar Bergman, who said, facts go straight to the head, but stories go straight to the heart. Mm-hmm. And so telling stories through music, through films, through TV shows, even video games and such, that touches people in a very powerful, visceral way. Mm-hmm. That if you're a Christian and you're putting your worldview into it, it doesn't mean you're making a Christian film. But it means you're offering a truth from your worldview that's powerful for people.
Matthew 13:34 says, when Jesus spoke to the people, he used stories. In fact, he didn't tell them anything without using a story. Yeah. And we're in a story culture at this moment. Plato said, those who tell the stories rule the society. So if we're trying to drive the story, then we need to be followers of Jesus. We need to be telling stories just like Jesus did.
Right, and that's a great point, because then if you're thinking that we're not, as a church, encouraging people to pursue the arts, then we're not giving ourselves a platform to tell those stories.
It's so true. Another thing is that when God gives us an artistic ability, it's in our blood. And when we're told we can't do that, I've met people in their 50s and 60s who literally cry and say, I've wanted to do it my whole life, and I was told I couldn't be a good Christian and do that. And I think as believers, we need to find out the gifts that God's given our children or the young people, and then encourage them to pursue that and to use that for His glory.
If we're created in the image of God, you know, the very first verse of the Bible says, in the beginning, God created. Mm-hmm. So he must like creative people. Mm-hmm. He wants us to be co-creators with Him.
Yeah. So then what would be some tips for someone who is artistic and they want to go into the industry? What tips would you give them to stand strong in their faith and then be that light in the industry?
Well, the first thing is they do have to pursue God first. Mm-hmm. He's got to be first in their life. And they have to be willing to know the lines and boundaries that they would draw before they come there. Because if you come naively thinking that everything's just going to work out, there's temptation and there are struggles and there's competition and there is hardship. And when you come prepared, knowing that you're ready to walk into it. If not, it's hard. We also tell young people they have to come and get involved in a church. Mm-hmm. They have to be a part of a small group and they have to pursue their craft. They can't just assume because God called them there that they're ready. They have to be good at what they do as well. And it seems impossible, but that's what Jesus wants us to pursue the impossible so that He can work through us.
Yeah. What would you say?
I think it's important for you to get an education, mm-hmm. to get affirmation from other people. If you want to be in an actor, you need to go to theater school, or you need to spend a significant amount of time in theater. It doesn't mean you were in the lead in your junior high play. You need to get encouragement from other people and a real evaluation. And then there's a great verse in Jeremiah 29, verse 5 through 7. It says, go to the place that I have sent you. Build houses and then plant gardens. Eat the food that you grow. Get married, have children, increase, don't decrease, and then seek the peace and the prosperity of the place that I've carried you, and pray for it. Because if it prospers, you too will prosper. So if you're going to come to the entertainment business, listen, come with a realistic view, plan to stay, plant your garden, eat the food from it, and then seek the peace and the prosperity of it, no matter what your place is going to be. It may be behind the camera. Most likely it would be behind the camera. It could be in catering. It could be in hair and makeup. We need so many hair and makeup people in Los Angeles.
Spend hours with these people.
You've got actors captive for hours. You can literally lay your hands on them. And as you're working on them, you can pray for them.
Yeah.
It's a great opportunity.
Yeah. And to get involved in our community. We tell people, call the Hollywood Prayer Network. We'll plug you in. We'll tell you what's going on. We'll make sure you find a church and a community of people. We say Hollywood is not Sodom and Gomorrah. It's Nineveh. It's it's being redeemed. It really is.
Well, God bless you and your work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
To hear more from Jim and Karen Cavell, visit hollywoodprayernetwork.org. Now we're going to head over to Give and Take, where Jeff is talking with RZIM's Abdu Murray about what he thinks is the strongest evidence for Christianity. Let's check it out.
Hello, Jeff Zwerink, and welcome again to Give and Take. This is the segment of the show where we look at important scientific ideas to equip you to share your Christian faith. Today, we're on site at the AMP conference, and we're interviewing some of the speakers to see what they think is some of the strongest evidence in support of Christianity. And today, we're joined by Abdu, and I'm excited to hear what he has to say. Abdu, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me, Jeff. I appreciate it.
So I've enjoyed friendship, getting to know you. I know you've got an interesting background, Muslim, a lawyer, lots of things that look at how data works, different religious worldviews. So just kind of give me a little bit, what do you think are some of the things that really weigh in and say, yeah, Christianity is what is true?
Well, there are so many different ones, and I want to focus on one specifically because, you know, time is a constraint, obviously. But from my background, you know, as a Muslim, I thought that the Christian idea of one God in three persons was ridiculous and silly, and I thought that it would actually denigrated God's greatness, and therefore Christianity had to be false. So when I began,
Why did it denigrate God's greatness?
Oh, because the idea that God the Father is God, God the Holy Spirit is God, and God the Son is God. If God the Holy Spirit, God the Father is God, why would he need help from God the Son?
Okay, so it's like it was a lesser God because it was less capable or something.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay.
But also it seemed to be incoherent and these kind of things. So I thought it was insulting to God's greatness. It was over the course of some years when I began to see that the Trinity actually not only makes real philosophical sense, but it actually extols God's greatness. That's when I began to say, you know, this is not just worth thinking about. It's actually worth believing. And it actually answers not only the Muslim or the Unitarian, who's a theist, it actually answers atheists as well. And I can't tell you how many times I've actually had atheists walk up to me, or former atheists, that is, who've said, I was an atheist. I walked up to you at a skeptics night. You answered my question on the Trinity, and that's what pushed me over. I was like, the Trinity pushed you over? And they're like, yeah, the Trinity pushed me over, and now I'm a believer.
So what are some of the things, why has that played out for you and for them? What were some of the reasons that was powerful?
Sure, so if I look at, like, for example, and it's very related to how a Muslim looks at it and maybe even how an atheist would look at it. So a Muslim would say there is a God, and that God is one in his nature and one in his person. We don't need to complicate him with all these other personhoods within the Godhead. And Muslims usually fundamentally misunderstand what the Trinity is saying. But Muslims believe that God is great, that he is the greatest possible being. There can be no being greater than God. That's why they say Allahu Akbar, and we hear it on the news all the time, but it's often a thing that Muslims say just in common parlance when they're talking to each other. Allahu Akbar, God is great. Mm-hmm. He blesses you, God is great. So God's greatness is very important to them. But here's the issue. If God is one in his nature and in his personhood, and he is the only uncreated being there is, then he needs something else to exist in order to be relational, because in Islam, as in Christianity, God is relational. So if he needs something else to exist so he can be relational, then he is deficient because he needs something that's not within himself to be who he is. The Trinity actually solves the issue because there is one God in three persons. He is inherently relational because Father loves Son, Son loves Spirit, Spirit loves Father, and on it goes in the community of the Trinity from eternity. So he never needs relationship. He defines relationship, and that actually would help a Muslim to want to believe in a God who is great, because in the Trinity, God needs nothing.
You know, that to me is a powerful point, and it was one of those aha moments kind of reading through Scripture, is realizing that God doesn't relate to people. Mm-hmm. God is relational.
Right.
And we don't relate to people. We, being made in God's image, are relational.
Right.
Yeah, but your discussion there is intriguing, because there's an idea, that idea actually means that there's a greatness to God that can't be fulfilled in a single God with a single nature and a single personhood.
Right.
That's pretty powerful.
Yeah, it's actually, thinking of God in Unitarian forms actually is deficient. So people often think of the Trinity as a problem to solve. It's actually a solution to the problem itself of how can you understand God to be coherent, which goes to the atheist part. So there was an atheist who put out an argument who said Christian theism is incoherent. He said that if God is perfect and God is loving, that's a contradiction in terms, because if you're loving, then you desire relationship. And if you desire relationship, then you lack something, and that relationship fulfills it. So God either is loving but not perfect, or perfect but not loving, but Christians say he's both, which is incoherent. The Trinity also solves that problem,
right?
Because God never, he loves, but he never lacks, because he defines it, which is exactly why in 1 John chapter 4, verse 8, it says, God is love. It doesn't say God is loving. It says God is love. He defines it. So for the Muslim who's looking for a God who is great, and for the atheist who thinks that Christian theism is incoherent, you can actually see them both. But it also explains something as well. Just listening to Ken Samples talk about the human condition and the human desire for connection and purpose. The fact that God is triune as a being in community, a being who defines relationship, if he is the cause and we are the effect, then it explains why we as an effect love, want, value, crave, and mourn the loss of relationships. A blind, pitiless, indifferent universe that has no relational quality to it whatsoever, as our cause, simply can't explain why we want those things so badly. I think the being who is relationship actually explains those things better.
You know, and another thing I just kind of interested in your comment on, as I've thought about the triune nature of God, that God does not need us for relationship because he's got, you know, he's one God in three persons. That if, then that kind of begs the question, okay, why did God create us knowing that we were going to fall?
Yeah.
To me, that has this connotation of there's something inherently valuable about us to God, but also it's not like God is creating us to fulfill a need for him, that he is creating us and inviting us into something that is so much bigger than who we are. So there's this fascination or, oh, wow, that's cool, not, okay, we're kind of solving a problem for God.
Right, and we don't. I've heard Christians say this before, like, why does God create us? Because God was lonely. Well, that's just not biblical, and it's not even philosophically tenable. But if God is triune, and you say, well, why does he create us? He has perfect relationship. Why create us to mess things up? And the reason is, and I've often thought about it this way, is that God doesn't create us, as you've pointed out, God doesn't create us so that he can have relationship. God creates us so that we can have relationship. It is self-giving. He is not suddenly more God. He's not like more fulfilled because we exist. He defines love, and out of the abundance of love, he gives selflessly. There's nothing he gets out of it that makes him more infinite or somehow more powerful. He just exhibits love by creation and creating us as free creatures who can do bad things, but actually can love him in return and actually have a free love, an actual love. That is an expression of what it means to be God. So he creates us not so that he can have relationship, but so that we can. And that, to me, is the greatest possible being, a being who loves, not out of selfish ambition, but out of selfless giving.
Well, thanks, Abdu. I really appreciate your comments.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, a lot of people do raise the objection that the Trinity makes God incoherent or it makes Christianity incoherent. But when you dig in and explore, it really is a powerful doctrine articulated by no other religion except for Christianity. And it just magnifies the perfection and the love of God that he shows for us. You know, I would encourage you to go check out some of the resources that Abdu has by going to rzim.org, search for Abdu Murray, that's A-B-D-U-M-U-R-R-A-Y. You'll have a wealth of resources that would help you understand the Trinity better so that you can share God's love with those around you.
And that does it for us this week. We hope this episode has helped equip you to share your faith with confidence and compassion.
Well, I don't know about you, but I had a lot of fun. I hope you had a lot of fun, and I hope it encourages you to subscribe to our show and also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are at 2819 Show.
And don't forget, you can get the podcast version of 2819. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, and Spotify. Just search Reasons to Believe Podcast.
We'll see you next week.